the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. I hope you're having a great day out there, making some money, growing your business, and just having a better life. We have an amazing show for you today. First up, we have Lane Kawaoka. He has built a real estate empire. He's going to give us each step along the way. It's an amazing story. After that, we're going to talk with Dr. William Haas about a new way of doing medicine, the new types of medicine. It is going to blow you away. It's all that scientific sci-fi stuff that's going to be awesome. Here we go with a great show. I'm very excited to talk a little bit of real estate and how you can build your wealth. Please welcome Lane Kawaoka-san. He is a Hawaii resident, mahalo, and has a wealth empire that he has built in the real estate space. He's raised $230 million to gain $2 billion of assets under management, some 10,000 units. An amazing story. Lane operates the Wealth Elevator, and you can find it at that.com. Lane, welcome to the show. Hajime mashite. Dozo yoroshiku.
Hey, yeah, and aloha, everybody. Thanks for having me.
So, tell us your story. You were working for the man, and what happened?
Yeah, so we'll study hard to the whole 401k traditional investments. And, part of that is becoming an engineer, started to work and was saving maybe $20,000, $30,000 a year, which again was not down this linear path of buying a house to live in, which I did. I didn't really care for the job and I was, you know, a little bit desperate to speed things up. So I decided to rent out that home. And that was kind of where I got the taste of cash flow and everything changed from there, you know, got essentially became a landlord. Although, you know, one of the big secrets is you always hire a third party property manager to do your dirty work for you. But I was good money and I was opening other streams of income with that first rental property. This is way back in 2009, 2010.
All right. Here's a funny family story. My middle name, I don't tell people because I hate it so much, but the guy was that I'm named after was a slum landlord. And his trick was he was the manager and the owner. And his trick was to say, oh, let me talk to the owner. He's a real jerk. I'll hope he's on a good mood today. I'll ask him if you can get a new toilet. And then he'd call back later. I talked to the owner. I really went to bat for you, but he said no. All being the same person. And that's the scumbag I'm named after. And that's all I know about him. Can you imagine naming your kid after someone and that's all they know about that person?
Yeah, but that's a great negotiation tactic. That's for sure. The deference of authority, I think that one's called. Yeah.
Okay. I hadn't heard a name for it. I just called it the scummy operating method.
Yeah. That too. But
all right. So once you got the little bit of cash flow, what did you do? All right. So you don't have any place to live right now though, right? You've rented out your house. Where are you living?
I'm living on the road at this point. I was lucky enough to have a great job as a construction engineer and made some good money. And at this point I was saving close to six figures every single year. Really no, very little personal expenses. So this is what really expedited my path to financial freedom by, you know, being able to save so much. And, you know, that first property was in Seattle. It was a very nice property, what we call more of an A-class rental property. Obviously, it was, you know, a place I wanted to live in initially. But, you know, later it started to discover, like what you started to mention, didn't quite become a slumlord, but started to move down a little bit halfway down that scale to more of a B-class rental property. As I started to learn that, you know, on the high end, you know, you're just not going to get the numbers to work. Or specifically, what we look at is something called the rent-to-value ratio, where you take the monthly rent divided by the purchase price. and you're looking for something pretty close to 1% or higher to be able to cash flow. So I bought a duplex that was a little bit more on the Class B side on a little bit rougher side of Seattle. And, you know, I think that was 2012. And by 2015, I had 11 of these rentals. At this point, I had started to buy properties in Birmingham, Atlanta, Indianapolis. Very different markets than Seattle, a lot cheaper, but really a lot better rent-to-value ratios.
All right, so can we go through the ratio again, the ratio that you just gave? So if you buy a house or a rental for $200,000 and you need to get 1%, you set out to make it cash flow, does that mean $2,000 a month rent?
The second step, right, that's where you put it into the full analyzer. We've got a copy on this on the website for folks for free. But, you know, this is just a quick and dirty way of evaluating properties. Right off the bat, you know, anybody can go to Zillow, see what a property will transact for the market price. And, you know, now you can even figure out what the rental price is on there. Another great tool out there, I don't know if people still use it, Rent-A-Meter, another way of figuring out what the properties should rent for. But yeah, those are your two big pieces of information. So you take the monthly rental price divided by the purchase price or market value, and that's your ratio, looking for something close to 1%.
Okay. And how do you know what market? Why did you choose Birmingham and Atlanta?
Yeah, so markets are separated into primary, secondary, and tertiary markets. So primary markets are, you know, obviously very desirable places to live, like Seattle, like Hawaii, like California, New York. Probably not the best places for cash flow investing. Now, it may appreciate, but appreciation is getting lucky, in my opinion. You know, what we're looking for more for is the cash flow right off the bat. And therefore, the primary markets, you might as well not even look there. So we're looking more at these secondary and tertiary markets. So secondary markets are maybe not the sexiest markets, like Dallas or Houston or Jacksonville, Florida, for example. And then you've got tertiary markets, which is a lot smaller markets, probably under a million, couple million population. These are more of like your Spokane, Washington's, your even a Waco, Texas, if you have heard of that place, just to give some examples.
I spent a summer in Waco, Texas.
See, you know, everybody's been to these places, right? But they tend not to stay there if you've got money to dictate where you live. But, you know, this is what one of my big investment theses is I try and go after the working middle class, the workforce housing, because in this sector, you know, you've got a lot of hardworking people that are a little bit underserved. And at the end of the day, when you look at the bell curve of Americans' population, they don't live in primary markets in sexy A-class rental properties or houses. They live in, you know, just sort of C-class, D-class housing. You know, rents in middle America of $900 to $1,200 a month rent.
All right. I own a rental property in Atlanta, and I get 5 calls a day, people trying to buy it from me. It seems to me, well, at least here in Atlanta, there is zero flip inventory or purchase. I don't think you would find anything in Atlanta, my experience. Plus, I talk to a lot of flippers here. I know you're not a flipper, but I think it's the same purchase pool. They've given up almost in Atlanta because they can't find anything to buy. What is your experience?
Yeah, I mean, that's how it is in residential real estate, which is why in 2016, I graduated more to commercial real estate. The reason being is to get away, as you're saying, from the common person buying little rental properties under a few million dollars in purchase price. When you can get above that really competitive layer, you can really find a lot better deals, you know, when you start to get above into the commercial asset class. And when I mean that, you know, we're talking 50, 100 units. Great. Right now, I can put a full-time property manager at the property at all times. Running around, you know, half of Atlanta, you know, on 100 units. together. Most of their time will be spent driving from property to property in a car. And then I can also put a full-time handyman on staff to knock out repairs. And obviously, it's a lot of good cost issues there by doing that. But that's one of the main reasons why we stepped up to commercial apartments, because it's just a little bit more scalable. We have invested. But this was after I had 11 rental properties myself, right, past 2015. Started to realize that a lot of wealthy people, or what is called accredited investors, people who have $1 million net worth or make over $200,000 a year at their jobs or their businesses, you know, they have access to get into these syndications and private placements at one time. You know, this is what the REITs invest in, right? All the institutional investors in. But when you go through them and not directly with a small ownership group, I mean, you're paying so many middlemen in the process. But yeah, you know, there's nothing passive about rental real estate, as you said. I mean, people are calling you all the time. That's why you get a property manager. But you know, if you kind of fight through, you get to this commercial scale, things do get a little bit less.
Can you start with commercial?
You know, if I'm not a guy who sells courses or sells education on it. Obviously, they're going to tell you can. In my opinion, you know, I'm not giving any financial advice. I think you need to start off with a bunch of rental properties first, if not just to get your net worth up and experience up. That's why the Wealth Elevator, I've outlined different steps to this wealth building game, the same steps that I went through. You know, I don't think that you just go from, you know, 0 to 100. I think it makes more sense to, you know, get your net worth up. I was lucky enough to start off with a good paying job, started with just one rental property, and then bought another a couple years later. And then I sort of exponentially grew from there. But, you know, I got to what I call the second floor of the Wealth Elevator, where I had all these little rental properties, 11 rental properties. And, you know, yeah, it equated to a nice $3,000 of passive income every single month, which I'm not going to complain. But it also came with a lot of headaches. And I had like an eviction or two every single year, some kind of big catastrophe that happened every quarter. And I really started to like scratch my hand. And it's like, well, this is just becoming a second job, even with the professional property management. And this is about the same time I started to meet other investors and started to uncover, yeah, people started to transition out of rental property ownership, but typically when they became more of an accredited investor, $1 million net worth or greater.
All right. So how are you finding those kind of deals? Do you find those deals on Zillow, or is there a commercial real estate site that we need to know of?
Yeah, I mean, the commercial world operates a little bit more traditionally than the residential world. You know, the projects that we go after are a little bit more, you know, stabilized. You know, yeah, you can buy more distressed assets and go after them, and those would probably transact off market. But the type of properties we like to go after are 90% occupied or better, and therefore they're controlled by, you know, the broker community. So out there, there are, you know, no different than any other industry. There's a handful of different brokers out there. To name a few, like, you know, a CBRE is a big one, JLL. You know, these are the groups that will own the deal flow to these types of assets and go from there.
So you call them and say, hey, I need a broker.
Yeah, you basically need to get access to these assets through a broker. And at that point, you're able to get these types of properties, the deal flow. But the problem here is the brokers, they kind of work both ends of the deal. In residential real estate, you have an agent for the seller and you have an agent for the buyer. But in commercial real estate, typically the agent represents both buyers and sellers. And it's normally they're working with the seller first, and they come and bring you in the buyer. So, I mean, you're working with more sophisticated parties in commercial real estate, but, you know, at this point, it's really the bell at the ball is the seller typically. you know, because the buyers typically can, you know, get, it's a pretty, there's no website for this stuff, right? There's no marketplace per se. I mean, there is like a somewhat of a commercial MLS, but, you know, deals are, there aren't that many apartments out there. You know, I don't know what the true numbers are, but maybe for every 100 single family homes, there's maybe only 100 decently sized apartments that you go after. So it's a lot more relationship driven. You know, you get presented different types of deals, but this is where, you know, if you're not a sophisticated buyer, the commercial property broker just will typically just send you, you know, horrible deals your way, you know, to use crude language, I guess.
I had a situation 25 years ago that I wanted to buy a space commercial for my business. And I told them exactly what I wanted. I want 2-story open space with brick walls. And I don't care where it is. I just want brick walls and 2-story open. And the guy showed me 20 places, nothing close to what I wanted. And finally, I was like, I'll go by myself. And then 6 hours, I found a place that was exactly what I wanted. It had been on the market forever. And I asked my broker, why didn't you show me this place? And he hummed and awed and blah, blah, blah. And finally, I found out that it was just listed with a different broker and he didn't want to show it to me because he didn't like that broker. And I ended up renting or buying it through someone else and then got in trouble. And it was a big pain to get out of all that. Loved the place, though. We were very happy with it. It had the greatest brick walls ever, just gorgeous. And I was so turned off the commercial broker space. To me, they just seems kind of crooked almost. Or just so brother, like, you know, good old boy. If you're not part of the good old boy, they don't even want to deal with you. And I don't know. I was very turned off. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I didn't want to say, but it is a good old boy. I mean, look at it from their point of view, right? Like they're talking about transacting $10 million, $100 million assets, and you know they stand to lose, you know, $50,000, $100,000 is a very small broker fee for them. You know, typically they may be making multiple six figures, maybe even seven figures on this. Unfortunately, their big motivation is, will this potential buyer they're bringing, can they close? Are they sophisticated? So sometimes, you know, we have to go in and even do interview to bid on a property or to become the best and final. And this is, you know, it, when you look at it this way, it kind of makes sense, right? So, I mean, initially, you know, I was kind of starting in the business in 2015, 16. It took like a couple of years really to get going after, you know, taking a look at hundreds of properties. And, you know, all those initial properties were just crap deals. You know, you mentioned websites, you know, maybe, I don't know if I can say this, but, you know, there are websites out there that were essentially, you know, it starts with the letter L and it ends with oops. But basically it's where deals go to die. You know, those, deal's on there.
What L and then oops at the end, what's in the middle?
Well, they can go on.
You're allowed to say you don't like this website.
Yeah, I mean, it's like LoopNet, right? It's kind of where deals go to die. It's a very public website. People can check it out, but you know, if a deal's on there, it's not a good deal. It's been passed over by hundreds and hundreds of people at that point. But you know, where a lot of these brokers will share deals, and then eventually ends up there. You know, most deals never work. I mean, we're trying to find deals where, you know, it's a good asset, but there's some type of distress in the seller, which is why they're selling it for maybe below market price. You know, I mean, that's where you make your money on the buy. You know, we also come in, renovate the units, bump the value, you know, which takes time, you know, and that's more called forced appreciation is really our business plan here. But, you know, we try and buy the best deal on the front end. But this is where, the second big barrier I think people entering is, you know, you've got to qualify for the debt on these things. And if you're buying a $30 million asset, the people you're partnering with, or maybe you're taking on the deal yourself, the you know, you guys need, or yourself needs to have a net worth of $30 million. And so basically you need to have like, you know, maybe you have three guys who have a net worth of $10 million to sign on that note. And you need to have previous experience taking down big properties like that. And that's, I think, the one that really gets a lot of people. It's kind of a chicken and the egg. Well, how do I get that experience, that sign off, if I've never done this before? Right. Right. So you have to have somebody on your partnership team who has. And this is where I think knocks most people out of the game. But how do you still continue on through, as most entrepreneurs typically will find a way? Well, what I've realized is a lot of people will get direct access to these types of assets to what's called a syndicate means, where capital formation will happen legally, typically through like a 506C or 506B offering. You know, I'm not an attorney, but people can look that up. But, you know, you've have like passive investors jump on board a syndicate and, you know, invest passively through one entity is sort of like a partnership. And you have a general partnership who finds the deal, puts it under contract, runs it, puts the debt in their name, and, you know, runs it on behalf of the partnership. And what I realized, all these accredited investors were, you know, diversifying their net worth, maybe putting, you know, percent of their net worth into, you know, dozens and dozens of these types of deals and building their portfolio this way. And the biggest difference maker between the average person, aside from obviously getting access to higher quality institutional assets, is that they were getting access to directly, right? There was only one little party there, you know, working their asset as their general partner versus, you know, traditional investments. You've got, you know, layers and layers and layers of middlemen and a lot of big buildings too and offices to pay their staff.
Yeah. Out of curiosity, I went to LoopNet. And there's several auctions on there that are happening right now that are kind of interesting to look at. But I just ran across Horvath and Trembley. You know that company?
No.
I went to school with Horvath. So I know that guy. Anyway, there's some really interesting properties on here. It's sad to think that these are already passed by everyone else because they look like great properties. And
well, that's you know, that's pictures, right? I mean, I hear online dating.
Like porn.
This is
like real estate porn, Lane.
Yeah, but you know, everything on, you know, in commercial real estate, as you said, everything is a good old boys network and it's a relationship based. It's the real estate of the old days. Residential real estate doesn't work like that, right? That's more B2C. A lot more unsophisticated buyers and sellers, and you just have a lot more people, and it's a lot smaller numbers to work with, right? I mean, 6% agent commission on a residential property seems a lot less on, you know, 1 or 2% on a commercial property, but the commercial property is oftentimes what, a factor of 100 or even more bigger.
Yeah, I know a guy here in Atlanta that does nothing but commercial real estate. And he said that he's happy if he does one deal a year. And he's making, he lives in the best part of town. So making a lot of money.
Yeah, must know something. Must be doing something, right?
Yeah, he's doing something right. So very, very interesting. So how many total units do you own now? Or not units, but how do you count when you have a commercial bank building or something? That's hard. Is that one, or do you count that as four?
Yeah, I mean, we help people, you know, go through these types of deals. I mean, when you start to realize there's this world of accredited investors more directly investing in a lot of these syndicates. And we see a lot of deal flow. We also help people, we also educate people on how to look at these types of properties. But one of the big things is you don't want to work with an operator or sponsor that hasn't done at least $1 billion of deals, just as a, you know, very quick and dirty form of qualification. You know, commercial real estate is typically done, I think we've done about a couple billion of acquisitions, previous acquisitions in the past. But yeah, you know, commercial real estate, you're talking big numbers, you know, a few hundred that $1 million of commercial real estate isn't that much of a track record. So that's what we look for. And then, you know, when we look at any deal, we take a look at the P&Ls, the profit and loss statements from the last couple of years, the rent rolls, and we'll typically run it through our analyzer and underwriting team and not just take the words from the person promoting the deal. I think that's a big thing.
Sure. Can't ever do that.
And, you know, they'll either look at like what a broker tells them. I mean, you never listen to what a broker tells you, and you certainly can't listen to what a sponsor operator tells you first. And this is where we emulate what's called a family office. The family office is typically
very similar.
$1 million network. But they've got a lot of money. So their job is to find the best investments and to diversify that. So they run around, interact with general partners, sponsors, or maybe even do a little deals themselves directly as an operator. And so they're maybe interacting directly with brokers, but you know, that's essentially what we do these days is we look around for deals. We use our network and I'm trying to find these investments that are direct to the source. And, you know, there's no website for this stuff, really, you know.
Yep. I know here in Atlanta, it's trendy now, has been for a long time, to sell your house off market, to never even put up a sign. And it shows how, you know, how wonderful your house is, but how also you're part of the network when you can do that. You go to the bank, tell them your house is for sale. Tell two or three of the right people and you start to get offers. And that's, you know, for the millionaire class, those people, that's the ultimate thing that they're trying to do now, sell their house off market because that's an extra badge of how cool they are. So they brag, didn't even have to put up a sign, didn't even put a sign up, just sold. So anyway, Lane, congratulations on a great, great, great career. And you are great example for all of us. How do we find out more? Follow you online, get information from the Wealth Elevator.
Yeah. So, the Wealth Elevator, I wrote this book last year. I was struggling to find books out there that was catering towards people who, you know, had good jobs or maybe already an accredited investor in this world of investing and alternative finance and alternative investments after, you know, you get to that level. You know, like I said, I started on that first floor of the Wealth Elevator, didn't really have student debt, had a good job, able to save good amounts of money. And, you know, I plugged away buying little rental properties for 2009 to 2015. But then I think the meat of the book is more of this transition to being a passive investor. How to get deal flow, how to do different. And then opens up all these alternative tax strategies that, you know, will go well beyond 401ks. And then another thing that we didn't talk about today, if another tactic used by the wealthy. My parents weren't that I started to uncover, but as I started to network and get into these both stores of accredited investors. That's my book, The Wealth Elevator, found on Amazon. If people want to check out my podcast, also The Wealth Elevator. And if you're an accredited investor, you know, send me an email at thewealthelevator.com.
Lane, thank you so much for being with us. Great story, and we'd love to have you back. Great job. We are back. And again, thank you so very much for being with us. You know, if you read the media, you hear about all of these billionaires who are hoping to live forever with all of these body enhancements. And well, be interesting to see if that works out. But what if you just want some improvement in your life? And we will talk about that with our next guest. Please welcome Dr. William Haas, MD and MBA. He is the founder and CEO of a company called Vive Wellness. That's V-Y-V-E Wellness. It is a wellness clinic that specializes in longevity and optimizing your cellular health. He is a board certified family medicine doctor and has trained in that field. Dr. Haas, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Very good. Happy to be here. Happy to be here. Excited to talk about optimizing health and extending longevity.
So are we really hoping to live longer?
Glad you led with that question. So we actually, the focus, I think, really should be more on what we call health span and less on longevity. And I think longevity medicine or longevity is not the current buzzword, if you will. But I think what we're all after is really just ensuring that the years that we have left are as healthy as possible and able to enjoy the years that we have. And if we can extend those and extend the quality of those, fantastic. But I think it really comes down to health span and not necessarily like, can I live to be 120?
All right. So we just want to live to be 90, but have those better years.
Absolutely. You continue to enjoy those passions and hobbies during that time and not just kind of be sitting in you know, a long-term care facility or a nursing home, you know, kind of not really able to fully enjoy the last bit of that life, or, you know, sitting there counting out 20 medications and your life is surrounded by the next doctor's visit.
Yes, I can relate to that. Already been to the doctor once today. So what are the methods to make that happen? What kind of treatments are you using?
Yes, to me, it's really less about the treatments, and it's more about the foundations of optimizing cellular health. And sometimes that obviously is going to involve some really cool technology and treatments and some of these kind of futuristic things that you hear about that you kind of let in with on this conversation. But the foundation is cellular health. And what I mean by cellular health, it's really things like mitochondrial health, things like the cells that produce ATP or energy, or metabolism, how your body is managing blood sugar, and then how your body helps like detoxify and clear toxins out of the body. How do you manage and mitigate inflammation? How do you help encourage cells to heal and repair themselves naturally and ensure none of those cellular processes get too far off track? Because the further and further they go off track, that is where we head down the road of chronic disease and then conventional prescription medications that have their own side effects. So, happy to talk about some of those tools, but I do want to make sure that we kind of make the focus on optimizing cellular health and enhancing what our bodies naturally do and its own innate healing capacity.
Is this becoming a whole specialty of medicine now? Like, is this your entire specialty now, I guess?
Yes, I mean, I was technically board certified in integrative medicine alongside family medicine. And I think you're seeing some new pockets and roots, right? So you have functional medicine, integrative medicine, this kind of longevity, which I feel like underneath that is this cellular medicine. So, and I think one thing that has spurred that field is peptide therapy, right? You did ask about one of the tools. One of the tools I use a lot will be peptides. And peptides come in all
shapes, forms. I don't know what that is. What is a peptide? Sounds like a
cleaner. Yeah. And in the essence, it's really just a string of amino acids that regulate different cellular pathways, right? And so if we bring that back down to something that most people can relate with, the very first peptide we ever kind of synthetically created from our own bodies is insulin. That's a peptide, right? I mean, people are familiar with collagen peptides. And of course, the big thing right now in the media is GLP-1. Peptides, glucagon-like one peptides, the Wegovy, Ozempic. Exactly. Those are an example of a peptide, and there's all sorts of different peptides that regulate different cellular pathways, be it metabolism, be it inflammation, be it circadian rhythms. That's kind of what peptide therapy boils down to, and I think that's what's driving this new interest in the field of cellular medicine, which has a direct correlation of tapping into the body's innate healing response to what I was talking about earlier.
Okay, so what are some of the treatments? I'm on your website and I see people doing all sorts of weird things. Like there's this big machine that they get into that looks like it's a tanning machine with all of these red dots on it. What are some of the tools?
That'd be some infrared light. Infrared light therapy. Yeah, so Yeah, so infrared light will mix that along things like hyperbaric oxygen and cryotherapy and lasers and IV therapies, to kind of name a few. And the each one kind of have their own purpose. IV infrared light therapy, we use it a lot to activate mitochondrial cells. I spoke about those earlier, the cells that create ATP, or the currency of energy in our body, right? So you're just feeling a little run down, tired and fatigued, that sleep and coffee can't get. Infrared light can be one of those foundational tools. It's also a great tool to reduce inflammation. It's been shown to help support collagen production in the skin. So think like anti-aging, wrinkle reduction, things like that. And it's really about how do you take tools like infrared light, and to me, not do this self-service biohacking approach, right? Where you're just like, I'm going to walk into a facility and choose a bunch of things off the menu. It's, you know, at Vive, it's really about how do we think about cellular medicine? How do we think about patients coming in with their health goals and then synthesizing a plan using these different technologies that you talked about, right? Do I pair infrared light with hyperbaric oxygen and then use a peptide, or do I use IV therapy with a laser? And that's really kind of the core and essence is figuring out how do you actually stack these different therapies together to maximize the benefit.
So are there particular therapies for particular diseases that people walk in with?
Yeah, and it goes back to the foundations of cellular health. So let's go back to, let's say we're looking to help an individual optimize metabolic health and weight loss, right? We want to facilitate weight loss. And, you know, sometimes you'll see those GLP-1 weight loss drugs get a bad rap. And I think it's because you're not really thinking about the foundation of how do we support somebody's metabolism and metabolic health. So a GLP-1 peptide may be a fantastic tool and the backbone of that, because it allows your body to process blood sugar better. It communicates with fat cells and allows your body to kind of start processing the fat cells up through metabolic pathways. It kind of modulates and downregulates cravings. But we may then layer in some other support tools. We may use some IV nutrient therapies to help ensure that the body is getting the amino acids that it needs to maintain lean muscle mass that you hear everybody worried about when they get that Ozempic face, which is generally a result of not getting enough protein, right? So we're layering in things to support, ensure that you get enough amino acid foundations to maintain that muscle mass, or things like B complex vitamins to support your metabolism. Yeah, there's another cool device you probably saw on the website, which was an emerald laser device by Arconia. And what that is doing is creating small little pores in the fat cell and allowing the fat cells, the content, to get broken up, emulsified, if you will, and let your body's lymphatic system naturally clear that out to shrink the fat cell. So now you have a couple tools going on at the same time, right? You have a GLP-1 peptide that's optimizing metabolic cellular pathways, right? You're supporting the metabolism with some of the IV nutrient therapies, and then you're just straight shrinking the fat cells with lasers.
All right. So what about a particular disease like kidney failure or one of the stomach diseases, IBD or Crohn's? Are there treatments for those sort of lifetime ailments that people are getting?
Yeah, fantastic. So autoimmune conditions is another fascinating and fantastic, kind of potentially chronic lifetime, but we're really trying to see if we can reverse that or help people manage those conditions without being on some of the conventional medications. And so a lot of times for something like inflammatory bowel, Crohn's, or ulcerative colitis, you're looking at what is aggravating and irritating the immune system to attack the intestinal cells and the GI tract and the gut. And that could be that there's what we call dysbiosis, or an imbalance of good and bad bacteria, or an overgrowth of yeast in the gut. So that's where you're kind of peeling back and looking at what are the root causes that are driving some of these chronic diseases. And once we address the root causes with things like more peptides, right? Great peptides to help support healing in the gut, could be something called, oral BPC. You could consider using things like lorazepam to help heal leaky gut. At the same time, we might be using herbals and botanical supplements to help rebalance the good and bad bacteria in the intestinal tract. You know, if it's severe, we may consider using things like hyperbaric oxygen therapy to drive and force the healing of the intestinal cells and quiet that inflammation. But I think underneath that goes that going back to looking at the root cause and then addressing, you leveraging those tools to address the root cause to see if you can mitigate and help elicit that natural healing response in the body.
Are these procedures covered by normal insurances?
Yeah, unfortunately, when you're kind of really trying to talk about root cause, a lot of times they're not, unfortunately. And you're really trying to get insurance to kind of get caught up with how do you manage things from a preventative standpoint? How do you manage things to address the root cause without having to rely so many on these pharmaceutical medications? I really wish it were the case. And there's some areas you're starting to see that kind of change, but they're slow to catch up with some of the literature on this. I think one area I'd love to see that get caught up is hyperbaric oxygen. There's only 14 FDA approved indications for hyperbaric oxygen, even though we know it has in the literature a wealth of healing benefits. I'm hopeful for the day that catches up.
And these machines look expensive. So what would some of these procedures cost then? They look really expensive.
Yes, there's definitely an investment in that technology, but it really comes to developing a treatment plan, right? I mean, you'll see, you know, what I call these biohacking centers or kind of these self-service longevity clinics where you can go in and do hyperbaric oxygen for $125 for the hour, right? Or you do a red light session for $25, right? But again, it really goes back to less about just, hey, I'm going to do a transactional payment and jump in and try one of these devices and hope they work. It's more about building out a plan and ensuring that plan makes the most sense for what is happening in each individual's body, and it aligns best with their goals. So usually it's more about synthesizing a plan that, you know, incorporates multiple different modalities over time, if that makes sense.
Yes. So how did you learn about all of these? Certainly not in medical school. They don't seem to be covered these. And talk to me about being an entrepreneur doctor. Doctors are not supposed to be good business people. My father was a pathologist. He was a very good business person, but a mediocre pathologist, perhaps. What are your thoughts?
I'd love to learn more about that story.
Willie, listen to this. I had a cyst on the side of my face right by my eye, and the doctor popped it out and put 2 stitches in. And we were going on vacation, so Dad said that he would just take the stitches out. He took the stitches out and tore the suture open, and I had to have 5 stitches to repair the 2 that my dad couldn't get out.
There's the difference of a pathologist and a plastic surgeon. There you go. I love that story. You
know, he did get his MBA when he was 65. Obviously, you did it much earlier than that. Talk to me about being a pro-business doctor. That's just, you know, doctors are not good at business, Will.
Yeah, we're programmed to think differently. But I think from an early age, I always wanted to build things. I wanted to create things. And, you know, one of the things that kind of drove me towards medical school, unless perhaps, you know, becoming an accountant or becoming an econ major, was this fascination with the human body and optimizing health and human performance, which is what sent me to medical school. And then when I got to medical school, I very quickly realized this is about managing disease, right? The system is about managing disease. And I kind of had a bit of a moment of crisis of like, okay, what did I just commit myself to? And so I decided to stop and take some time off in the medical school and go get a business degree, because I figured I needed to learn some sort of language and have the ability to ultimately end up creating something that was going to be outside the conventional medical realm, which is what kind of led me early on to get that business degree. And then it really kind of became all about just kind of self-exploration to figure out how am I going to do this, right? And it led me down the path of going into integrative medicine, which is the only place that I really felt at the time that was speaking about kind of prevention and wellness and tapping into the body's innate ability to heal itself with all sorts of different tools and therapies, not just what we learned in medical school. And that, so that ultimately kind of said, like, okay, I'm going to have to do this on my own, right? I tried spending a little bit of time in academia, wasn't cut out for the bureaucracy of that. So they kind of then went down this road of a couple different entrepreneurial ventures, right? And one of the things about being an entrepreneur is like, you don't always get a home run out the park, right? I had a lot of what I'd say were kind of mediocre attempts and creating different startup ventures, but learned from every single one of those. Probably the most valuable thing I learned during that journey was marketing, right? How do you ethically market and sell? You said, like, hey, you kind of brought up, like, these things aren't covered by insurance. So how do I create a treatment plan that I feel like and I know is going to help an individual, but then how do I convince them to exchange, you know, make an exchange of value in dollars when it's not covered by insurance? So probably the biggest thing that I spent a lot of my time learning earlier on my career as a physician entrepreneur is kind of marketing. That was probably the best skill I picked up.
Interesting. And so what has been the marketing mix that works best for Vive? How do you thread that needle?
Yeah, so I think we really focus on trying to address those root causes up front, right? So what has been very powerful for both the business but our patients is kind of starting with a foundation of different diagnostics or testing that is matched to the symptoms they're experiencing and the things they're hoping to achieve. All right. So, I very much dislike where it's all cookie cutter approach. Sometimes you'll see that in functional medicine where you just kind of walk in and everyone gets the exact same workup, but kind of having a foundation of lab testing matched to patients' ailments or concerns or areas they just feel stuck with their health. And then fleshing that out to understand, okay, here's what I need to focus on. Here are the tools, back to our earlier conversation. You know, here are the tools that I think are best fit and positioned to help this individual with Crohn's, because it looks like their inflammation is really high and they got an overgrowth of yeast in their gut. And then we kind of start crafting those tools to help that individual heal. So it is very much a process of getting people bought into a series of labs, seeing what the labs match up to the story they have. And then we can then generate the plan and say, hey, here's what I'm thinking, you know, and then very clearly have a conversation around the investment to achieve that plan.
All right. Obviously, you're located in the rich parts of town, Ballantyne in Charlotte. Where are you located in Charlotte?
I'm actually located in South Charlotte. It's kind of been a bit of a transitional edge, right? Like any big city, like Atlanta that you live in, like Charlotte up here, pockets of the city change pretty quickly, but we are in the South Charlotte part of town.
By the mall there? Which mall is
that? Yeah, South Park area. Yeah, you got okay. It.
Yes. Very nice part of town. I had two kids who lived in Waxhaw, so right around the corner from you.
Yeah, not too far down there. Yeah, I mean, we love the location that we're in, kind of super convenient around town. We have a lot of patients that also fly in and out, so it's not too far from the airport. And it's in a really cool building where when you walk in, the whole inside of the building is this atrium, right? So there's just trees and shrubbery and fountains. So it kind of supports that healing environment. So I kind of really love the building that we found in Charlotte.
And what are your plans for the future? Obviously people are flying in, you need to grow to other cities. Is that the plan or what do you have in mind?
Yeah. interesting side story that we didn't talk about. So a few years ago, I was approached by some investors and, been approached by a couple of different PE firms along the way to perhaps do just that, grow Vive. But I made an intentional decision about 3 years ago where I really wanted Vive to be its own organism, you know, it's kind of unicorn, where we really kind of put a stake in the ground where we say, hey, we are one of the nation's best wellness centers, right? And I want people to be able to come and experience that in person, and really be able to control that feeling when you walk in. And so I decided, you know what, I'm just going to leave Vibe as is, and I'm going to take everything that I learned as that physician entrepreneur to run a very successful, efficient operation. And I'm going to go teach other clinicians how to do this. I'm going to help them and give them the tools to do the same thing, to be able to run the back end of their offices, to generate revenue tracking software, to generate inventory tracking software, to leverage better contracts with vendors, and created a company called Infusive 3 years ago, co-founded it with my business partner, Darren Frank. And we're now in over 300 different clinics across the country, helping other clinics run the back end of their offices, similar to the way we do at Vibe. So that was my conscious decision 3 years ago, was to actually go less down the route of, you know, creating a bunch of eyes throughout the country. I feel like we do very well at what we do. And I think it speaks that we have patients flying in from all over the country and the world. We have patients that come in from Costa Rica and the Dominican Republic. So yeah, that was kind of that side journey and side route to create the company Infusive.
Very interesting. And are you the main doctor at Vibe? Is that where you practice now? 100% of the time?
I practice there 2.5 days a week, and then I spend 2.5 days a week with the Infusive team. I have a fantastic team of nurses. So we have a team of three, getting ready to hire a fourth nurse, who are really great extenders, you know, especially when you're coming in to do these different modalities. We have another three, what I call wellness guides, that help patients when they're doing things like the hyperbaric oxygen and the laser therapies. And then I have another nurse practitioner looking for another one. So if there happens to be any listeners out there that are looking for a new home and a really cool place to work, we are growing and expanding the team. But a lot of the advanced treatment plans will be developed by myself and overseen and helped run by members of my team.
Excellent. I looked at your team. You have a lot of good looking women on your team. I noticed that, William.
We've tried very hard to get guys to join the team. I mean, it has been a challenge to find dudes. And every time we open up the application pool, I tell my director of operations, can you please find me a guy to join the team? But no, they're fantastic. I love the team that I work with. And they're a big reason for the success of Vibe Wellness.
Well, it's an amazing story. It's an amazing story. It seems like that eventually this will just take over all of medicine.
You know, one of my mentors, Dr. Andrew Wild, always said, you know, I really wish there wasn't such a thing as integrative medicine, or to paraphrase his words, he thinks this is the way medicine should be practiced, and it shouldn't be a specialty. You know, it's just the way it should be practiced. And I think we're catching up and we're getting there. I think it's being driven a lot more by the individuals and the health consumers that they see and want a different way.
Very, very clearly true. How do we find out more? Schedule an appointment? Become part of the team, learn more.
Yeah, best place is just vibewellness.com/get/or-started. Vibewellness.com/get-started. There's just a little intake form, or it gives you an opportunity to tell me a little bit more about you and some of the health goals you're getting. From there, we can jump on a discovery call with one of my wellness specialists, and they'll learn a little bit more about those health and wellness goals and see if we might be a good fit, and can talk about next steps from there.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations on a really cool business, and we'd love to have you back to watch it grow. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
We are out of time. Be safe, take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now. Oh, yeah, go buy the book, Real Environmentalist.